Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning for today's program with the State Comptroller. I would like to particularly welcome many of the guests that we have in the room, and thank you for being here also. And to remind you also right up front that this program is taped by WCNY-FM, and it's broadcast on Sunday at 8 p.m. if you'd like to listen, and then sometime thereafter it is podcast. So if you'd like to recommend it to those of your friends. You will be getting the April-May schedule for the upcoming sessions. There are 5 remaining sessions to this season, so you won't want to miss them. I'll just give you a heads up on the next couple of weeks. Next week, as I've been telling you, Mayor Miner will be here, Syracuse Mayor Miner, talking about some of the fiscal challenges that the city is facing. We've heard about them before, but I'm sure she will have an update for us that will scare us out of our pants. No. The week after that, Heidi Holtz and Kristen Heath, who were the co-chairs of this year's Onondaga Citizens League study, will be talking about refugee resettlement in Syracuse. Very interesting topic. And I'll leave the next couple of weeks, the next few weeks, to tell you about over the next few days. But the next few weeks, remember that we have 5 sessions left. That's it. And we end up on May 2nd. One other thing about next week, though, it is the 1600th TMR session. So that will be something we will mark with a couple of displays for you. Right now, it's my pleasure to welcome our State Comptroller, Thomas DiNapoli. State Comptroller DiNapoli first took office in 2007 and then was elected to a 4-year term in 2010. As the state's chief fiscal officer, he's responsible for auditing state departments as well as local governments. And I think we saw a few weeks back his assessment of the state of the city of Syracuse. He also is very importantly in charge of managing the state's pension fund, the state's retirement fund, state and local retirement fund, and also for reviewing the state budget. So maybe he'll tell us a little bit about what he thinks about this year's budget that may or may not be passed today as we speak. Who knows? Earlier in his career, Mr. DiNapoli was a state assemblyman from Nassau County for about 20 years. And although, if you recall, a few weeks ago we were impressed with Ithaca Mayor Myrick, who started his career in the city council there as a 20-year-old, and we actually saw him on his last day as a 25-year-old mayor of Ithaca. Now he's 26 and old hat. But anyway, Mr. DiNapoli was elected to the Mineola Board of Education, I believe it was, as an 18-year-old in 1972. And maybe, does that record still stand? The youngest, sure, at 18. The first. So, if for nothing else, welcome, State Comptroller DiNapoli.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is great to be here. I can't tell you how many times we tried to schedule the opportunity for me to be part of the Thursday Morning Roundtable. We finally have a date that worked. So, thank you, Sandra, for that introduction and for working with us very patiently on the schedule. I always get a kick when my first venture into elective office is mentioned. You can imagine what it was like being a high school senior running for a seat on the Board of Education the first year that 18-year-olds were allowed to vote. There was a fair amount of skepticism, but fortunately for me, my community put aside that skepticism and gave me the chance to serve, and hence all these years later, we're still at it. My only quibble, Sandra, is that as I get older, I don't like when the year is mentioned, because then everybody starts going, oh, okay, so 72. So I hope you all said, my, he looks terrific for his age. I hope that's what you felt. Now, I tried to follow the program, and I was very deliberate in my choice of ties before I came to speak with you. So I wish the Syracuse Orange basketball team the best of luck in the Sweet 16 tonight. And I've learned more about Keith Smart than I ever knew before. If he's lurking around that arena, we got to make sure that, you know, we keep him outdoors or something like that. And I was so impressed. Sandra, what did you say, the 1600th you're coming up to of the round table? That's incredible. This really is has become an institution, longer running than a lot of our talk shows on TV. And I really want to commend each and every one of you for participating in this program. I know many of you are regulars, and I know you're busy, and I know some of you will be coming and going, and the fact that you take time on a regular basis to participate, I think that's really outstanding. From my point of view, especially given how I began and the era that I began in community work and public service, it seems to me in the modern era we've gotten away from this kind of civic engagement where you have the chance to share ideas and interact and do it in person. You know, everything now is tweeting and Twittering and, you know, Facebook and everything else. I'm a little old-fashioned. I prefer these kinds of venues and forums, so I really congratulate you for keeping it going so strong. And I'm also very grateful that, in addition to seeing each and every one of you, I got to see three folks that I'm very fond of that were kind enough to come out this morning. I was mentioned that I served for 20 years in the state legislature, and I had the privilege in many of those years to sit in the same row as the great Joan Christensen, your former assemblywoman who's here. Where's Joan? There she is, right there. We had a pretty good time in that row. We would kibitz a little bit, and that budget, we were in those 3-4 in the morning nights sometimes. Say, Joan, what are we voting on? Joan, what do I, you know. But Joan just did a great job representing you, and I just feel a little bit, because she looks better than ever. So a former life is agreeing with her, and it's just great to see you. It's been too long. Another one of your great leaders in the Syracuse community, and someone who I got to know over the years, and I know she's not in public office now. I hope one day she will be again. Bea Gonzalez is here, and where's Bea? There she is. She's wonderful, and her work at the university, her work with the city. You've been very blessed with many, many outstanding elected leaders in this part of the state. And I have to mention someone else who was a big help to me as I became state controller and traveled the state and got to know the different parts of the state, including Onondaga County. And that's the former Democratic leader, Diane Dwyer, is here. Where's Diane? There she is. Always with a wonderful, generous spirit, and thank you for introducing me to this county on so many occasions, and I appreciate that. I'm told I got about 20 minutes or so I'll try to throw a few different things at you, give you an update from the perspective of the Comptroller's Office about where things are at with our economy, a little bit on the budget. They are in the middle of voting on it, so we know somewhat what's being done, not everything. You know, keep in mind, as Comptroller, we are the office that handles the money, but we are also the office that, unlike the legislature, unlike the governor, we're not the policy office. So we don't decide who's getting what money. We're the office that, after the legislature appropriates the money, we make sure it's being spent appropriately. We process the contracts. We process the payments. We have audit responsibility. So after the money's let out, we audit state agencies. We audit local governments to provide some level of oversight and accountability on the money. And obviously, as Sandra mentioned, we have a big responsibility with the state pension fund. I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I'll run through a few things, and then I know we'll have time for discussion, and we'll take that conversation wherever you want it to go. Obviously, everybody's concerned about where we're at with our economy. And that's been the big issue that we report on a regular basis. And certainly, our analysis of where we're at with the state economy is key, because where the economy's at is really the foundation to what's happening with the state budget in terms of revenues coming to the state and what kind of money is available to spend. We've been through a very tough time. I don't have to tell you that. The meltdown in 08 and 09 had a devastating impact all across our state, and we have had a very slow process of recovery. On many measures, New York State has fared better than a number of other states, but it's all relative. It's all where you sit in terms of what the impact has been on you. I think it's fair to say, as we've measured the various indicators, and I'll mention a few of them, we certainly are on a path of recovery, more positive signs than negative signs. But it's also fair to say that our recovery is a very slow one, a very tentative one, a very tenuous one, and obviously there are many factors at play that could set us back, depending on how all that proceeds, and I'll touch on some of those points. So where are we at? What's the most important point that everybody's concerned about? Jobs. How many people are working or not working? Our state unemployment rate in January of this year, 8.4%. A little bit higher than the national average of 7.7%. It was interesting. During the earlier parts of the recession, New York's unemployment rate was better than the national. Now, you know, we've been a little bit higher for the past year or two. Unemployment figures are always subject to interpretation because it has to do with the labor market and who's available to work, but you know, we're trending a little higher than the national average. Here in the Syracuse area, in this region, unemployment rate was at 8.5%. Pretty much on track with the state, right? 8.4, 8.5, pretty much the same, a little higher than the national average. In terms of overall job creation, because the real issue was how many jobs were lost during the recession, from the depths of the recession to today, we've added about 360,000 jobs. That's about 111% when you look at the jobs that were lost. So in the past few months, we finally, as a state, turned the corner where we've actually now grown back all the jobs that were lost and then some. The challenge with that number, while it's a very good statewide number, and this is again where we try to be helpful in interpreting the data, it's a different picture depending on which region of the state you're talking about. So New York City has actually, the five boroughs, come back like gangbusters. They've grown back about 175% of the jobs that were lost. They've done the best. My home region where I live on Long Island, just over about 110% of the jobs have been grown back. That's a recent trend. Buffalo, about 74%. Rochester, Mid-Hudson Valley, regained about 70% of the jobs. Syracuse region, only grown back about 22% of the jobs. So you've grown back some of the jobs, but you're behind other parts of the state. So to me, the bottom line on just determining where we're at with our recessionary time, until we see those unemployment numbers really go down and have a statewide distribution of that job growth, we can't say that we're out of it. The housing market, very, very important. If you remember, the recession really started with a downturn in the housing market. Again, we're seeing some recovery statewide and in your region as well. Looking at the most recent data put out by the Association of Realtors for the state, statewide home sales in 2012 were 7% ahead of 2011. Onondaga County, home sales were up 11% in 2012 over 2011. So actually, in terms of home sales, activity in real estate, you're doing better than other parts of the state. Median home sale prices in Onondaga increased only by 1% in 2012. But the reality is that shows a level of stability on prices. In other parts of the state, including where I live, although there's more activity in sales, prices are actually trending downward. So it's positive. On the negative side with housing, there is an uptick once again in foreclosures. Statewide, they've increased by about 30% from 2011 to 2012. Here in Onondaga, you had an increase of 20%. So less of an increase than the statewide numbers, but part of what's happening is, you know, foreclosure in New York takes a long time, and now some of the new cases that had been held off are starting to happen. Keep in mind, though, New York really did not fare as poorly as many other states during the foreclosure crisis. It's a crisis if it's your neighborhood or if it's your house, but relatively, New York did not fare as badly on that issue as many other states. Sales tax collections, those are important as revenue to the state, to local governments as well. It also shows consumer confidence, willingness to spend. Statewide, here in your county, from 2011 to 2012, sales tax collections were up 5% compared to the statewide number of 3.3%. So that's an area, again, where we're seeing more economic activity in your county than we're seeing on a statewide basis. And I think that's a good sign. For our state, one of those areas of concern that we're still trying to grapple with is the impact long-term of Superstorm Sandy. Obviously, it was more a downstate impact, but in the upstate areas, you had Irene and Lee from the year before. With Sandy, you know, we're still doing the assessment of what the ultimate cost and damage is going to be, and you followed what was happening there in terms of roadways and airports and water systems and so on. It does appear that between the federal government money and private insurance, most of what is going to have to be paid for will be covered. But there is concern on the timing, especially with regard to those federal payments. And those of you who are friends or family downstate, you know how everyone's fighting with the insurance companies to get those payments as well. And that gets to another area of vulnerability, and that's what's going to happen in Washington with the sequester. Will that have an impact not only on the Sandy recovery aid, but on other important programs that the federal government supports in New York? The early estimates are that over a period of years, we could lose as much as $5 billion to the state and local governments of New York if there is not some compromise on what is laid out in the sequester. In a short-term impact, the estimates are that we could lose as much as $436 million just in this year alone. So what our federal representatives do to work that issue out as part of the federal budget discussions are very, very important. And the cutbacks will come in areas, no surprise, education, public health, safety, childcare assistance, so affecting some vulnerable populations. So we have to be very, very concerned about that. So where we have the economy, more positive than negative, mixed bag though, some vulnerability, different parts of the state performing in different ways. There's no doubt, though, that part of having our economy come back is to have a better foundation in terms of our state budgeting practices. And here's an area where, again, I think we've made progress over the past couple of years. I give credit to the governor and the legislature for being more realistic, first of all, in the revenue estimates. Not that I've necessarily been on board totally with their revenue estimates, but compared to a few years ago, where we had wildly optimistic revenue estimates at halfway through the year, you can remember, cutbacks in the middle of the year to local governments, vendors not getting paid in a timely fashion, grants that were promised to not-for-profits not coming through because there wasn't money there, again, because the budget was built on overly optimistic assumptions. We're in a better shape in that regard. The real challenge for New York is, long-term, how do we balance our recurring revenue with our recurring spending? And we still are in a mode where we get through a budget year, and we get through a budget year better than we have going back 3 or 4 years ago. But long term, we still have gaps that are out there in terms of long term structural balance. So the Senate did their voting till 4:30 in the morning. The Assembly is going in later today. So what we do with our office is when the governor proposes the executive budget, we do an analysis of his proposal. We identify what we consider to be strengths or risks to that budget plan. And then when the enacted budget is finalized, we do a detailed analysis of that as well. So I don't have the detailed analysis yet because we're just reading the bills as the legislators are. And that's one area of concern. I mentioned to Joan when we were talking before, in an effort to be more efficient, and obviously I appreciate the fact that for the third year in a row now we'll have a budget done on time, a little bit ahead of the deadline of April 1st. But the concern is, in the interest of efficiency, are we sacrificing too much when it comes to transparency? How much do people really know about what's being negotiated? How much do the legislators that are voting know what they're voting on before they actually have to do it? And that's a concern. And Joan, we can remember some of those years where we had the same question, and it looked like we were moving away from that. Conference committees, more public debate and discussion. Now it looks like we're moving back in the other direction. So I appreciate the efficiency and the better working relationship. We shouldn't sacrifice transparency, though, as we move forward. The other issue, as you know, there were many non-budget issues, and this is not new, but there seemed to be a lot of it this year tied to the budget discussions, right? So you could argue, great, everybody's focused, they'll make decisions. You could also argue, some of these issues don't impact on the budget. Why are they being debated? Could they be holding up some of the budget decisions? So minimum wage, as you know, was a big issue being debated about, some of the gun issue. Some issues were dealt with, some issues are being put off to later in the session. We'll evaluate that when the final product is done. We'll look at the big categories, though. What did they do with school aid? It looks like it's about $1 billion addition there, about close to 5%, as I understand it. What's happening with Medicaid? There have been very specific targets in terms of allowing for some growth, but limiting that growth. Obviously, Medicaid is important to families in need. It's important to our healthcare institutions in terms of their viability. Big debate this year about aid to families with developmentally disabled family members. There's been an issue with the federal government about New York being over-reimbursed in that category. There have been some changes there. There was a restoration, I think, of about $30 million of the cut that was originally proposed. I think some of the advocates are not totally happy with that restoration. We will look at that. And the other big area that we always have a concern about in our office is debt. New York is one of the most highly indebted states in the country. Much of that debt now Some of you look like you're old enough to remember when we used to vote on propositions, right, before there was a borrowing. When's the last time we did that? Under the state constitution, the voters were the ones to be the final check on borrowing. We've moved away from that. Now much of the state debt is done through public authorities. And while that, again, may be perceived to be more efficient, what you lose is transparency and accountability. And I've advocated for a long time that we need to go back to empowering the voters to be the final arbiter on debt issuance. Now, of our outstanding debt, only about 6% of the debt is voter-approved general obligation debt. So well over 90% is that, as we call it, the backdoor borrowing of the public authorities, and that continues in this budget. So that's certainly a very, very key concern. The real issue, though, becomes the question of revenue projection. And again, I think there was a more honest accounting for revenue, but right before the budget negotiations kicked in, they upped the revenue assumption by about $200 million. Again, what we've seen even during this past year and even the year before, even with better budgets, we've always fallen short on our revenue projections, especially with regard to personal income tax revenue. There's always growth year over year, but we fall short of our projections. And because there were some unexpected recoveries with some banks and some other federal money that came in terms of the timing of those payments, we're ending this year in balance. But again, the weaknesses in the revenue projections, that's an area that we're going to look very, very carefully. Translate the budget challenges at the state level to what's happening at the local level. And obviously, it's a similar dynamic. As Sandra mentioned, we put out our profile on Syracuse. We're doing that on a number of cities across our state. What we really see is that it's a combination of economic factors, some of them longstanding and historic, some of them related to the recent tough economic time, and an impact of what's happening with state and federal budgets that's really put a squeeze on municipalities and really our cities in particular. When you look at the different levels of government, and we look at all of them, the real front line for fiscal stress are our cities. And it's largely our cities. It's hard to generalize, but it's largely the cities outside of the Hudson Valley. So Central New York, Western New York, Southern Tier, those are the cities that are facing the greatest challenge. What do we find as far as Syracuse? And you can go on our website. We have the profile there. Obviously, the economy and impact of state and federal aid has caused real budget challenges. I'll give you a quick highlight for those of you who may not have seen it. Syracuse, like many of our older cities, dealing with long-term systemic problems complicated by the slow economic recovery since 2008. That's exacerbated the situation. Syracuse has a large number of vacant and tax-exempt properties, lower rates of home ownership compared to other communities, and a decreasing home value base. Cities have historically relied on property taxes as a primary source of revenue to fund their operating expenses. In Syracuse, though, property taxes account for only 13% of the city's revenue. Compare it to the average for all cities in the state, excluding New York City, where that average is at 26%. So it's half as much reliant on the property tax. And there are clear reasons for this disparity. Half of Syracuse's property is being listed as tax exempt. 8% of property is tax delinquent. Nearly 11% of the city housing units are vacant. So it's really put tremendous stress on that revenue source. We also found that Syracuse, again, like other cities that are challenged in our state, relying more on sales tax revenue and fees to cover the cost of municipal services. 25% of the revenue for the city coming from charges for services, such as transportation and utility fees, 22% from sales tax. Syracuse, again, like other cities, being faced with growing fixed budget costs that the city doesn't necessarily have a direct control over. Costs for the city, costs for the school district as well. Coupled with a population base that's getting older, needing more services, deteriorating industrial sector, all of this has contributed to the challenge. Syracuse has the second highest rate for New York City's of families living in poverty at 25.6%. And when you look at population trends, I'm sure I'm not telling you something you don't know already, from looking over a broad period of time, from 1950 to 2010, city lost more than one-third of its population. Again, not too different a picture than many of our other upstate cities. Syracuse lost $4.3 million in state aid since 08 and 09. And expenditures in the city have increased at an average annual rate of 4% from 2001 through 2011. So expenses going up, less state aid, more challenge with the population, more challenge with the property tax base and the assessed valuation base. So, you know, Mayor Minor has, I think, been very clear, and I give her tremendous credit for being, who's laughing? I give her tremendous credit for not being shy about indicating that the challenges you're facing are part of a larger systemic challenge that our cities are facing. She's been very honest about that, very forthright about that. When she first became mayor and we met, she was very honest and forthright about that with me when we met at City Hall, and she's been very honest and forthright in a public way that I think has really, elevated the discussion. Where it goes, I don't know, but I think Stephanie Minor is clearly laying out a framework for how we need to look at fundings for all of our local governments, but really our cities in a very, very different way. We released a report back in August that looked at what's happening with local governments. Because again, we get financial reports, we do our audits, we see the trends that are out there. We found, looking back to 2010, 2011, 300 local governments had deficits in those years. More than 100 had inadequate cash on hand to pay their current bills. So we also looked at, because it's the economy, it's some local decisions, but it's also the trend of aid that government depends on, federal government, state government. We found that looking over the decade of 2001 to 2011, total federal and state aid to local governments has grown slower than the rate of inflation. The relative share of federal and state aid as a percentage of local government revenues decreased from 22% in 2001 to 20% in 2011. To cover expenses, local governments have been forced to rely more heavily on revenues that are generated through sales tax and real property taxes. And again, for our older cities, declining tax base on the property tax side, sales tax very sensitive to what's happening with the economy. State funding to our localities grew by only 1.2% on an average annual basis. The majority of those increases were related to what's called the AIM funding, part of the state budget, aid and incentives for municipalities. However, funding for AIM has been reduced or held flat since 2009. It's expected to continue to be held flat at least through 2015, 2016. This year's budget did not increase any of the AIM funding. So again, these are policy choices, and part of what we're going to be looking at is what were the policy decisions to add money. Obviously, some money was added to different parts of the budget. Some tax credits have been added as well. A policy choice was made not to do more for our cities and our localities, and that's going to be worthy of further discussion with state leaders as we move forward. On top of all this, so we've got these economic trends, these budget trends, localities, including our cities outside of New York, have to also deal with the tax cap, which is another, depending on how you look at it, you know, positive change or another burden in terms of managing municipal finances at a challenging time and school district finances as well. It was a complicated formula. Our office was very involved with providing technical assistance and training to localities so they could implement the property tax cap in the right way. Under the law, we're charged with compliance, making sure that people are filling out their reports and doing their calculations in the proper way. As of last week, well over 90% of local governments and school districts have complied with the reporting requirements for the current cycle. And that's what we see in Central New York as well. We've already received 237 reports from the 270 municipalities and school districts that are expected to provide that information at this time of the year. We're going to continue to work with local government officials to make sure they understand how to implement the tax cap. As you know, there's a provision for overriding the cap under certain circumstances. Again, that's going to be a local decision. I think one of the things to keep in mind about the cap, because people are always saying, you know, is it going to be amended, is it going to be changed, depending on your point of view, whether you think it's good or bad. One of the numbers that we've been looking at is an interesting one. If you look at property tax revenue increases for school districts across the state from 2000 to 2010, they rose on average 5.4% a year. We just looked at what's been happening in the short time that we've had the tax cap, and it's actually limited, looking at 2012, to revenue increase through that property tax of 3%. So you already see a difference as far as the revenue that's being generated from the property tax cap. If the growth had been 5.4% as it had been before instead of the 3%, the cumulative difference could have been something like $3 billion statewide. So I think one of the questions that we're going to have to look at from a policy perspective, especially when you talk about schools, right? Nobody thinks they're getting their fair share of school funding, right? I remember that from my days in the legislature. Someone asked me the other day, I was in Hudson, New York, when are we going to have a fair school aid formula in this state? And I said, fair depends on when you sit, where you sit. I said, I've never been in any part of the state where anybody thinks it's fair. We all think someone else is getting the money that we should be getting. But certainly in terms of pressure on the state aid formula, if we're going to constrict how much money our schools can raise with the property tax cap, and keep in mind for school districts, by and large, for most of our school districts, there's a voter approval of budgets where there's a supermajority of 60% required, I really think it's going to put more pressure on that question of how equitably are we financing our schools throughout our state. So we need to keep looking at that issue, and we need to recognize that between the budgetary issues and the lack of sufficient state and federal aid, between the local economic trends that are challenging places like Syracuse and having the tax cap on top of it, and I think most local officials want to stay within the tax cap, how do we provide that relief? And I think that's really a big part of what Mayor Minor has been pointing out. Some of that discussion gets back to the issue of mandate relief. Again, a mandate depends on where you sit, whether it's pretty or whether it's ugly. There was, I think, a general sense that when the tax cap came in, that there would be significant mandate relief. And I think there's a sense now that we haven't seen anything like significant mandate relief. There is now a governor made his mandate relief task force, a permanent council. The hope is that they will come up with some more suggestions than they have to date. You know, again, on that, we probably have to stay tuned and see where it's headed. The other piece of this all that's clear is that the challenges that localities are facing, and to an extent the state is facing, is not a passing or momentary time in our state's history. It has become the new normal, and for the foreseeable future, we are going to be confronted with difficult budget choices on spending and on revenue. That's going to happen on the local level across our state. That's going to continue to happen on the state level as well. Part of what we're trying to do to help from my office on the local level is that we don't want to see happen in New York what we're seeing happening in other states. You've been following what's happening in California, where they have municipalities that are filing for bankruptcy. That has not been the history in New York. It should not be the trend for the future in New York. But we do need to do a better job of identifying earlier on those localities that really are in severe fiscal stress as a way to try to intervene in a helpful way. An intervention can mean more support from the controller's office in terms of long-term planning, help with building budgets, suggesting ways to be more efficient. It could be something as extreme as a financial control board. I live in a county that's had a control board since 2000. We're still in fiscal stress since 2000. Some of it in Nassau, probably more due to local decisions rather than some of the other factors. But the reality is the state in more recent years, we have about five control boards on the books right now. There's been a hesitancy to create many more control boards. So I think the real challenge is to identify earlier what communities have fiscal stress, to hopefully avoid a meltdown, number one. Number two, frankly, to engage the public more directly. You know, very often, you know, you're an involved and concerned group. You're watching what's going on. Many communities, folks don't know what's going on until there's a real crisis, until they read about it in the paper. And unfortunately, in some communities, local officials aren't very upfront about some of the problems that they're facing. So we have this monitoring system. Again, it's on our website. We're going to take the financial data we collect now. It's no new mandate on local governments. We're going to categorize for school districts and local governments, are they in fiscal stress or not? And if they are, we are going to provide more help from our office in terms of support. Moody's, some of the rating agencies, have commented positively on this monitoring system because it just gives people more information, hopefully a quicker way to come up with solutions to the problems that are out there. We need growth. There's no doubt that growing our economy is key. The governor, as you know, has used the strategy of the regional economic development councils. There's more money for those councils in this budget. I think it's a smart strategy because you engage local decision makers in setting priorities. I want you to know the pension fund is part of that equation as well. I know when you hear about the pension fund, if you're a member, you're concerned about where it's at, and I want to tell you if you're a member, the New York continues to have the best funded of all the big state plans in the country. I'm a strong believer in protecting the defined benefit pension plan that we have. It provides retirement security at a time when many do not have that. It enables close to 80% of our retirees to stay in New York State, not move to Florida. And the temperature was like 30 degrees down there today anyway, so you were right to stay here. And retirees staying in our state, spending money locally, paying their taxes, that has a tremendous impact. We calculate, not even putting in the multiplier effect, we pay out roughly about $8 billion in benefits last year. We calculate at least $6 billion of those benefit dollars are staying right here in our state and being spent here. That's positive for our economy. Our return last year was a little bit under 6%, a little bit shy of what our goal is, but still, considering the investment climate, a good return. We value the fund March 31st of every year. So I'm lighting lots of candles and going to church regularly. I want you to do the same, synagogue, mosque, wherever you go, March 31st, which really, it's really gonna be Friday, right? Because March 31st is Sunday. The markets have been up. I hope they stay up. I know more about Cyprus now than I ever knew, and I'm not always happy about it. But we're hoping for a good end of year, which will mark now yet another year after that terrible loss we had in 08 and 09. And that loss was historic, not only for our fund, but for all investors when Wall Street tanked. And the reason the rates have been going up is that we lost so much, and we average the loss over 5 years. And imagine if, because we lost 25% in 08 and 09, imagine if in 1 year we had to make that up. It would have been devastating. But we're phasing it in over 5 years. We have one more year where there's going to be upward pressure on the rates. Then the rates will start to stabilize. Actually, I think they'll come down. They won't come down fast. They'll come down slowly. But our fund is well positioned. And what we're trying to do, getting back to that issue of growth, is reinvest more of the pension dollars that employees and taxpayers put into that fund and look for great investments right here. One reason why I'm in this part of the state is that a little later this morning, we're going to be in Auburn to announce the latest of our, what we call our in-state private equity investments right here in central New York, about a $3 million investment in Auburn Armature. This is part of a $1 billion fund that we've set up to invest money in a private equity basis in startup businesses, expanding businesses that already exist, or businesses that want to locate to New York from other states. It's of that billion, we've gotten out the door about 640, 1 million of that money, including two investments in the Syracuse area, specifically in Syracuse, and now we're doing Auburn. I think it's our first one in Cayuga County. So we've been able to retain jobs. We've added about 3,000 jobs by doing these investments. And the good news is we have more money to deploy. So if you know of any entrepreneurs that might be interested in this program, it's available. They can be in touch with our office. And I want you to think of the pension fund not only as a cost, as you often hear about it as taxpayers, but think about it as a fund that is trying to be part of the solution of moving our state forward, doing more to invest in New York, not only with our in-state private equity investment program, but we also support small business lending with the New York Business Development Corporation, with a prime financer of the loans for small businesses, a very important part of our economy, a very important part of the growth for the future. And actually, back in late 2010, I was in Syracuse, we announced an additional $100 million to that program. We have $400 million now that we provide in small business lending. And that's going to strengthen the economy here in the greater Syracuse region. It's going to strengthen the economy all across our state. So we, in the pension fund, try to manage it with discipline, but also look for that double bottom line. Make money for the fund, do good things with the money for the people of our state as well. So let me sum up. You've been wonderfully patient. Slow economic recovery, but recovery rather than moving backwards. Real challenges at the local level, especially our cities, and we've talked a bit about Syracuse, and Syracuse is not alone. Moving forward, we have to be smarter, we have to be more efficient, we have to collaborate more and share ideas more. It's a time where folks like you are more important too. When we're making tough choices, to me, when you have choices, even when they're tough ones, there are always better options. And some of that depends on where you sit, what your perspective is. But for us to move our communities forward, even if we're making tough choices on spending and revenue, we need to know what the people in the community want. And that requires an engaged citizenry. So besides participating in this roundtable, as I know you do, continue to be involved in your local cities, towns, villages, in your school districts as well. Your elected officials need to know what your priorities are. That's how it's more likely that they're going to, in the end, the decisions are going to reflect your priorities. And the reality is, always my experience, whether I was on the school board or in the state legislature or even as controller, the folks in government don't always have the best ideas. Very often it's the folks, somebody shocked to hear that. I see that? The first time you ever heard that. Very often the folks are on the front line in the business community, in the not-for-profit in the sector, in the school system, people active in community work. You're the ones that have some of the better ideas that we need to hear. So thank you for being part of an engaged citizenry here in this community. Thank you for supporting the roundtable, and thank you very much for being a very attentive audience to me.
Thank you. I know we will have several questions. We'll start right over here.
Thanks. Thank you for your presentation. The largest bulge in our population is the retiring baby boomers and the effect that they will have on municipalities. Can you expand on your remarks about trying to keep the older folks in the community rather than moving to Florida or some other places?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot there. I mean, that's part of why, I'll just briefly restate it and talk about some of the other pieces of your question. You know, it's why I've been such a strong supporter of the public pension system that we have, because I really think it's been an incredibly stabilizing factor in people choosing to continue to live in the communities that they grew up in and that they helped to build and create. And I think too often when pensions have been criticized, it's been because of the cost and not realizing the benefit. You know, but I'm also keenly aware that many people in the private sector don't have the traditional pension system and the retirement security that we all remember from years ago. My dad is going to be 89 in a week, and he is still an example of, you know, veteran, member of the greatest generation, where that old three-legged stool concept works. All right, so he worked for 40 years for Ma Bell. Some of you remember Ma Bell when the old days. Wasn't it so much simpler dealing with one phone company years ago? I don't know. We thought we were making it better, and perhaps we weren't. But that was a big corporation, and he had a lifetime career there. He has a modest pension, but it's a defined benefit pension. That pension, coupled with Social Security, coupled with the frugal savings he and my mom put aside over many, many years, it's working for him. He's still living in the house that he and my mom built after they married and that I grew up in. He's able to provide for himself. Yet that model is not available for many people today because they work in corporations where they moved away from that defined benefit pension, and they moved to 401ks. And especially if you were a baby boomer about to retire a couple of years ago, your 401k became a 201k at best. And some folks still haven't made back the money that were lost. So some folks that were going to retire in 08 and 09 and 2010, they haven't retired yet. And they're having to put that decision off. And there's more stress. And generally speaking, you know, the savings rate for many years kept going down. So the frugality that my parents' generation had, a lot of my generation has not had. And the challenge on the other end is that the boomer generation, because of advances in health and so on, are projected to live longer than the previous generation, although I don't think I'm going to outlast my father at the rate he's going. So how do we deal with that? I think the larger question is really one of how do we get back to setting as a policy, and I really think this has to be a national policy, to provide retirement security for people. It's very clear that from my research and from my perspective, 401ks were not set up and cannot function as a substitute for a pension plan. They can supplement it. I'm in the state deferred comp plan myself. I'm not opposed to 401ks, but it's a supplement to having a pension for me. So we have too many people now that are depending on personal savings, including 401k, have no other retirement income on Social Security. They're not going to be able to maintain anywhere near the lifestyle they have, hence the pressure to move to Carolina or Florida or somewhere cheaper. I have asked for a national commission to look at that retirement security question. It hasn't happened yet. California just passed an initiative last year to set up it's in a sense a parallel system to their public pension plan that perhaps would be managed by the pension plan to have a savings vehicle for people that aren't covered by a pension plan. It's still in the early development stage. We're talking about whether or not an idea like that could take hold in New York. I think we need to come up with some other strategies so people will have a new way to save that they don't have now, because there is going to be that big crunch. And I worry about people not being able to provide for themselves. And you know what? If they live long enough and they run out of their savings, we're going to pay for it anyway through social services and government expenses. So there is a government interest in figuring out how to provide more retirement security than we do today.
Hi, thanks for coming. Thanks for your enlightening, illuminating presentation. I recall the late Senator Moynihan used to complain every year about the disparity between what we send to Washington and what we get back. And when you're talking about the sequestration and how we're going to be getting less from Washington, it suddenly occurred to me to ask, is there any chance that we'll be sending less to Washington because they're needing less? And so that... So that we could, in a sense, make up some of the gap by spending it at home.
I doubt it. I doubt it. It's interesting. You know, somebody said the other day, nobody's really done those reports since Moynihan. You know, maybe we should consider doing one. I don't begin to presume to be an expert on the federal budget, but all of their issues and the debt of the nation. I don't know for the foreseeable future. You know, whether it's on operating programs where they are going to cut, but paying off that debt is going to require more and more money. We have to look at that whole relationship between the states and the feds. And look, New York is a higher income, higher cost state. I suspect we're always going to be sending more than we're getting back. But there clearly needs to be more of a balance. And you saw, and it was so frustrating, everybody across the country saw what happened to Metro New York City with Superstorm Sandy. And yet they played such politics with sending aid to our region. And there was obviously a regional prejudice against this part of the state. And I'm not saying that in a partisan way, because, you know, Governor Christie was yelling about that as much as anybody. There's a real problem, you know, with that relationship. I'll leave it to our federal representatives to deal with it. But we are actually looking. I'm going to mention to my staff that you brought up the Moynihan reports, because somebody said, why don't we do something similar? We haven't seen those kind of reports for a while. I think they were very interesting.
Thank you for your presentation. With all due respect, though, I don't understand how we can justify keeping the defined pension plan. Most corporations, not-for-profits, have had to freeze their plan because the burden of the investing is on the employer, not the employee. There's no doubt from an employee standpoint, a defined pension plan is absolutely the best way to go. It's very protective. I certainly get it. I hate the fact that we've had to freeze ours. But once you freeze it, the people that are in are still guaranteed their pension. It should be just for all new employees. As I understand it, New York State, it doesn't matter if you froze it today, everybody in it would still continue to get their funds, but at least it would freeze it for future employees. I just don't know how we can justify, as taxpayers, having to cover all of that, as good as it is for those employees.
Well, keep in mind, as taxpayers, you don't cover all of it. Actually, 80% of the benefits are paid by the investment return. So in a year where we have an investment loss, there is an increase. It's going to go down in terms of what taxpayer covers. But most people don't realize that still, again, part of it is the strength of our fund, a little different than some other pension plans. We're better than the national average. Most of it is still paid for by the investment return on the money that the employees and the employers put in. You know, here's my concern with your question. And I understand from an employer perspective what you're saying. If you freeze them and you have the new employees go into 401ks or defined, do you think that they are more secure or less secure in terms of their retirement? The employees are less secure. So to me, the solution is not making even more people less secure in their retirement. The solution should be the opposite. I happen to think corporate America, I'll leave the not-for-profits aside because they, you know, unfortunately end up having to follow the trends that are there. Corporations made a decision in terms of how they were treating their employees, where they moved away from these plans, and that became the more popular trend. Not that they've disappeared. There are still many corporations that have defined benefit plans. They're just less than they used to be. I don't think that was a good decision. I don't think that made our society stronger. I certainly don't think it made our retirees any more secure. So to me, to have even a larger percentage of our population not to have that protection, I think that's a bad outcome. And I think it will result in even more people having to move away. It'll result in more people, especially as our family structures change, that you don't have the traditional families. You have a lot of single people out there now, people without children. You know, who's going to provide for them? It's going to cost us as taxpayers in the long run anyway. So I would rather see, certainly from a public side, those plans, again, not New York's, that are in trouble, like Illinois, that, you know, something like 40% funded. Their liability is huge and growing. And part of that is because they made bad decisions. They, in the interest of taxpayers, many states, when times were good, did not fund their pensions. Oh, we got enough money there. You know, it'll be fine. Let's not fund it. We got to give money other places. We got to provide tax relief. And then we have a year like 08, 09. We hope it won't happen often, but we know there will be ups and downs. And they're really caught short. That's bringing down their entire fiscal structure for their state. They had to cancel a borrowing because they couldn't get a rating because of the underfunded pension liability. And so then you have this argument, well, the pension isn't properly funded, therefore we should get rid of it. I think we're doing a race to the bottom when we take that approach. I'd rather start to say, what else do we need to do to shore up, you know, the changed workforce? Many people don't work for corporations or even not-for-profits. A lot of folks are self-employed or they're small businesses. What kind of savings vehicles can we create to help them so that we have that retirement security? So I really don't think the answer is taking away from the people that have it. And I don't think we've adequately accounted for the benefits of having a cadre of people in our state that have a secure retirement. And you know what? And I know you said you'd freeze it so it wouldn't affect the people that were here now. I want there to be good people wanting to be school teachers still. I want there for good people to want to work in municipal government. And part of why people choose public service as a career is that it has been established that not if you work 5 years or 10 years, not if you work 15 years, but you work 20, 25, 30 years, you can have a secure retirement at the end of the day. 75%, I'm going back to a few months ago, I think the numbers are still pretty close, 75% of the retirees in our system, their pensions are $30,000 or less. You're not talking about people getting real rich on these pensions, but that $30,000 on average, coupled with Social Security, it enables them to provide for themselves and stay in their community. I don't want to give that up if I don't have to.
At so many of the points you made this morning, so many heads were shaking in astonishment. For instance, you said something like, just before the budget is approved, somehow $200 million in revenue appears. When you said that, one person at my table said, I wish I could budget like that. And another person said, if I did that, I would be fired immediately. How does that happen?
Well, part of the budget process every year is that there has to be an agreement between the legislature and the governor on revenues. If they don't come up with an agreement, then the controller's office sets the revenue. That's been in effect for about 5 years now. They've never not come up with an agreement because they wouldn't want us to do it. So they have a revenue projection in the governor's budget proposal that comes out, you know, the end of January. And then the final revenue number is agreed upon in the first week of March. So the legislature and the governor, based on their economic models, made a determination that there was $200 million more available than was first projected. It's a big number. Keep in mind the all funds budget is going to be about $141 billion. You know, so $200 million out of $141 billion, it's still, you know, a fraction of a percent. But often what has happened is that the revenue numbers have been increased after the governor first projects it. It does make it easier for them to come up with a solution. Part of this also gets back to another problem we have in New York. Our fiscal year starts April 1st. Our major revenue source is personal income tax revenue. Why we do our budget decisions or we have our deadline of April 1st and we don't even know those numbers because the deadline for filing taxes is April 15th, it's never made any sense. I think we're the only state that has a date that's not, you know, June or July or a calendar year. So, you know, many have advocated for a long period of time. At the very least, we need to push that date later, because if you don't have hard numbers, if you're just projecting on your personal income tax revenue, you're always going to be off. You might be too high, you might be too low. So I think part of the challenge is that because of the way we structure our calendar, there's always more guesstimating than there should be. But that's going to require a change in our, probably constitutional change ultimately, in how we handle our fiscal year. And there hasn't been the appetite. A few years ago, there was at least a one house bill to do that passed, or a two house bill that passed in one house. I think until we change the year that we do the calculations, we're always going to be off, because we're doing more guesstimating than we should. And now, you know, one of the arguments, I'm not justifying the late budgets of years ago, but one of the reasons why, given for having the budget deadline go past April 1st, was that, well, let's wait and see what the numbers are with the April 15th collection. That wasn't a good reason to blow the deadline, but that was one of the rationales. In theory, it would make more sense for us to have a later fiscal year. We would just have more solid numbers upon which to base the budget.
I'm one of those poor souls that doesn't have a defined benefit plan, and I'm now in my 42nd year of working. But my question is this, and I've agreed with many things that you said today, but I'm just curious, first of all, and this is a dumb question because I don't know, but do state employees pay state tax both when they're working and in retirement? And secondly, if you want to help people like me, give me a tax break. That would be a great way to make up some of that money I'm losing by not having a defined benefit plan.
So tax break tied to what, though? A tax break in general?
Well, you said that you were going to try and come up with a savings vehicle for people that don't have defined pension plans.
Right.
Could there be a tax break for people that don't have it?
A tax break if you don't have a pension. I never heard that suggestion, but I said some good ideas come out of, I'll think about it. I'll think about it. So pensions in New York, any pension up to, I forgot what the number is now, I think it's 20,000, maybe a little under 20,000, are not taxed. Public pensions are not taxed no matter what the amount, but everybody gets a break on the first 20,000 or so, and there have been some proposals to raise that even higher for private pensions as well, you know, as well.
One last quick question.
The state of Maine, just the governor, I don't know if he got it, but he proposed no taxes on any pension as a way to try to encourage retirees to move to Maine.
Joni Mahoney praised the governor's proposal for pension relief. Stephanie Miner criticized it. Who's right?
I didn't praise it. We had real concerns, and out of respect for, you know, the challenge that localities are facing, we were asked to work with Division of Budget to see whether or not we could come to some agreement. The way the governor initially proposed his plan, I think Stephanie's criticisms were on target. And my concern, and hers were from the perspective of local government impact, my concern was the impact on the fund. To basically say we're going to defer payments and 25, 30 years from now it'll all be made up, was going to leave the fund vulnerable to falling below what would be accepted as a healthy fund, able to meet its cash flow and pay benefits, and leave us vulnerable if we had another market shock like we had a couple of years ago. Because of the pressure on local governments, in 2010, we came up with an amortization program which would allow local governments to take a part of the increase, and it's been a significant increase over the past couple of years. And it's almost like balance billing with a utility, you know, where you pay the same rate. It would allow, it's not a flat rate, but it would allow a slower rise in your increased rate. And for the amount of money you would defer, some call it borrowing, I don't, I call it deferring, there'd be an interest payment and you'd have to pay that back the year after you do the deferral. So there'd be money coming back into the fund with an interest charge, so we treat it like a fixed income investment. Of the 3,000 or so employers in our system, less than 200 participate in that. But I felt that approach was a way to provide some short-term cash flow relief for localities and not harm the fund. What ended up in the budget was not the governor's proposal. What ended up in the budget was another version of that amortization that's a little different in that it allows a little more to be deferred, and instead of a 10-year payback, a 12-year payback. And instead of the rate going up only 1%, it would allow it to go up only 0.5%, and then on the downside, not go down as fast. So in effect, you'd be able to defer a little more, you get more of an upfront benefit, it'll take you longer to pay it back. And just like in the earlier amortization, it requires when the rates are coming down, you pay off your amortization and you have to set up a reserve account so you start to build up cash for when there'll be a spike in the future, how you could pay it. I'm okay with that program because it doesn't hurt our funded status. But it's definitely a different approach than what the governor had put forward. To me, and Stephanie's right, local governments are better off in the long run paying the bill, because that way you don't, you know, accumulate any interest or deferred payments. The challenge is for some localities, there is such stress as far as making budget choices. It becomes a question of services or laying people off. If this mechanism allows the opportunity to manage cash flow a little better, it's worth looking at. But I think anybody that's not in it now that opts into it should do it with great caution and understand the full implications. So, to the direct point of your question, I would lean more on Stephanie's side of that than on Joni's, but I think we came up with a mechanism that if you're a local government, you feel you need a safety valve, you now have two options, the 2010 amortization program or the one that's part of the 2013 budget. The governor agreed with it, we agree with it, the legislature agreed with it. So there are options for localities that are very concerned about the increase in rates that we're going through.
Thank you. Time will tell, I guess. Thank you, Time Controller.
Go Orange, right? Everybody go Orange. Thank you.